Hello and welcome to the Art Monthly Talk Show. I'm Chris McCormack, Associate Editor of the magazine. And today I'm joined by my colleague, Michael Kurtz, who is a writer and listings editor, and Lauren Velvick, who is Director of Corridor 8 and is Creative Producer in Berwick-upon-Tweed. I'm also hoping to be joined by Sarah E. James later in the programme, who will discuss her future exhibition as performance. Lauren will be discussing Roy Clare Potter's book, The Wastes, published by Bookworks earlier this summer, but we begin with Michael's profile of the Colombian artist Delcy Morales, who has come to international prominence over the past few years. Maybe like some of our listeners, I really only experienced her work at the Venice Biennale in 2022. I wondered, Michael, if we might begin by giving some background and context to her practice before we go into more detail about the works you encountered in Seville and in New York.
Yes, thanks for having me. So Delcy Morelos was born in the late 60s, is a Colombian-born artist of indigenous descent, and her practice has always been informed by a kind of, I guess, a meeting of a kind of minimalist formal tradition with spiritual traditions that she was raised with in Colombia. And as you say, she only became kind of, I would say, well known on the international art scene in 2022, really, with the Venice Biennale. I actually didn't see the 22 Biennale, so I'm interested to hear what your impressions were at some point. Her practice in the last, but before that point, was largely painting based. She did a lot of kind of Agnes Martin style, simple monochrome grids. Was very interested in the kind of meeting of painted grids with textiles. And gradually she started incorporating pigment and earth into her painting, and eventually began creating these more immersive soil sculptures, which is what she's become known for now. So her work in the 2022 Biennale was this large-scale earth kind of maze or set of geometric walls, which I didn't see. You might remember what it was like to experience it in the flesh, which I think is very important with this kind of work. But then I first came into contact with her work in New York last year. She had an exhibition at Dia Chelsea, which was an ideal setting really for her because she was able to engage directly with that minimalist lineage, which Dia is very associated with.
Mm. Yeah, I did see the work. I seen both those work. I saw the work in Chelsea, New York, and also I saw the Venice Biennale work. I guess similar to what you're saying, the encounter is incredibly rich and powerful in a sense of, you know, what on one hand is actually quite a simple work in a way. And I think you talk a lot about, in a sense, that in your piece, which is about, yeah, this experiential encounter and how that kind of really speaks to a more broader narrative around colonial and historical contexts that she's interested in as well as in exploring. Maybe let's begin with something about your encounter with the works at Chelsea as well and the titles of those works, and actually also the some of the materials in the two different installations she uses, because I think that's also interesting.
Yeah, so as you say, it's the kind of work you kind of have to spend a bit of time with. I've been very happy to, I reviewed that show in at Chelsea for Eflux back last autumn, and I was glad I did, because I think it's the kind of show that I might not have spent so much time with and got to grips with her, not been writing about it. Because I think my first impression was, which is what I guess I was grappling with in the profile, was a feeling that it was quite an escapist work. So there's these landscapes of earth in the middle of Manhattan. And my first feeling was that it was potentially a little bit simplistic, or like I was just escaping into this earth and then would return to the streets of Chelsea more or less unchanged, but having had this kind of sensory break or something from the city.
You mentioned quite nicely actually this idea of like taking a break from your lunch this sort of wellness retreat moment. I thought it was a really nice detail.
Yeah, I think that was my first impression, I guess, was that this was partly because it's so her work is so immersive, which I think immediately a lot of people are suspicious the moment they feel immersed is but then getting to grips with the materials, I realized or started to feel that actually she's a much more critical artist than I had first thought. And a lot of the writing about her again focuses on her spiritual interest, but maybe doesn't pick up on the kind of historical awareness and criticality of her work. So in the Dia show, there were two large installations. The first was called Earthly Heaven and was essentially a kind of gathering of fragments from previous exhibitions at Dia Beacon. It was works by people like Dan Graham, Dorothea Rockburn. So it was these kinds of fragments laid across a earth crust across the floor, along with various small pieces of Colombian pottery. And some zigzagging strips of kind of corrugated metal, all coated and painted in earth and brown pigments. And then she shaded the skylights, which was the only lighting available. I think they did have some strip lighting which came on at in the evening, but basically it was a very dark atmospheric space which would shift depending on the time of day. So you have this very atmospheric kind of tomb-like space with these fragments of avant-garde art. And I think thinking more about that was my first way in because I realized that she's got this kind of sense of humor in a way, and this darkness in her work where she's poking fun really at this kind of monolithic conceptual tradition, this very serious avant-garde. I'd love to know what the conversations were like when, or how that came about, her kind of use of Dia's legacy in that way. I mean, I'm sure that, Dia was in on the joke in a sense. I mean, they're still happily hosting the exhibition. But I think in that work, she's combining this kind of dead, like flotsam from the avant-garde, but then revitalizing it using her formal vocabulary and her very clever use of light and form to create this very dynamic space. I think on the one hand, she's poking fun at the, generally speaking, quite kind of white male American avant-garde, but also confronting it with a new model of creativity, a more cyclical, potentially sustainable model of creative production. I guess also, these kinds of short-term exhibitions do produce a lot of waste, and so incorporating that into her work in a kind of pragmatic sense is a kind of recycling.
Yeah, I agree. Also, it's kind of, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the interview I did this month as well with Jesse Darling, because he uses the fragments of Felix Gonzalez Torres's work in one of his sculptures. And it's that unwritten or unacknowledged thing of the material components that go into the production of an artwork.
Highlighting the waste, basically, that this avant-garde produces an awful lot of waste, and the art world in general does. And it's, I mean, with the Gonzalez Torres work, it's sort of repeatedly denied that the work produces any waste, isn't it? Which is also strange, given, its attention to the sort of materialist
Exactly.
theoretical tradition. So yeah, I thought it was an extremely clever. I mean, and to give Dia its due, I like the fact that the exhibitions there tend to run for, a year or something. They do tend to be interested in a kind of more longevity. They're not partly because they're not a commercial gallery, but they're not producing month-long exhibitions. And then in the second room, there was a very different kind of installation, which was a vast mountain of earth, essentially, sprouting with long blades of grass, and filling the room, leaving a sort of fairly narrow corridor on the at the perimeter of the room. And then at the far side of this mountain of earth, there was a deep opening, which you could walk into, and you could sort of you and the artist invited you to touch the earth, and it was a very strong scent of various mixes of spices and roots from Colombia. So this was the work that, for me, when I first encountered it, I really thought, oh God, this is kind of ruralist escapism, with a kind of, the label of indigenous tradition, that we then can, feel good about ourselves and reconnect with Earth, and then go back and tread the streets as if nothing's happened, like a kind of a very quick trip to like upstate New York. But again, I think that her use of minimalist forms, and specifically within the context of Dia, is a kind of way into thinking about the criticality of the work. So I started reading up about the kind of or and thinking more about the, I guess, the environmental credentials of canonical minimalist art, and thinking about how her work is positioning itself in distinction from that tradition. And I mean, in the profile, I detail some of these things, but the looking back from our current perspective, land art and minimalist art, which Dia has sort of championed, in some ways looks quite kind of dated now. Its attitude to earth as a kind of inert material that can be manipulated as conceptual fodder. And specifically, the thing that really sort of took me down this avenue was the opening of Michael Heiser's City in 2022, which I think is probably at the more extreme end of this problem. And her work, by contrast, is using soil in its kind of alive state, and trying to focus our attention on the kind of life-giving potential of soil. And there's very subtle little things. So I mean, in the minimalist and land art tradition, often soil is used to kind of it's used as a way of denigrating the spaces of art. People like Robert Smithson, very interested in like tipping and pouring and digging, and Michael Heiser kind of blowing earth up. So there's a kind of aggression and negativity to their work. And in her work, there's none of that. She's much more interested in raising soil up, using the spaces of art. So that was, I think she's quite consciously engaging with that tradition.
Yeah, even like Nancy Holt, in a way, those sun tunnels, which are now, I mean, not that that was intentional, but now they're used for shooting ranges. And there's actually bullet holes through the, or bullet scars through the sun tunnels. It's a sort of interesting connection to that. But in a way, then the focus of this piece also really is about the new work, or the work that's been recently installed in Seville, which you went over to view for us. Could you say something about this? Because it feels like this is also like a key moment in maybe, or a development in the work.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way, so those are the only these are the only two shows of hers I've seen. So it's kind of all I've got to go on. I'm looking forward to seeing what she does next. But in a way, I think she found the perfect she found the perfect location, really, with the Andalusian Center of Contemporary Art in Seville, because it's based in a beautiful medieval monastery that was, in a way, at or very near the center of very early colonialism in on the Iberian Peninsula. So this cathedral was one of the kind of favorite haunts of Columbus before he set sail. And then it was, once Spain became increasingly rich through colonial trade, it was a great kind of benefactor of that wealth. So in a way, she's found a you know, it's a perfect collaboration for her because she's found a setting which speaks to that history very directly. And again, I was thinking about ways of, I guess, refocusing the discussion of her work away from a sort of purely positive focus on Indigenous spirituality and more towards her like historical critique, really. And so in that work, it's very, the forms are often very similar. There's a similar, some of the works are very interested in plays of light and darkness. And then there's another work which is in the kind of main nave of the church in the compound, which is very similar to the mountain in Dia Chelsea, a kind of very simple monumental form.
Yeah, I
And
mean,
in
there is like a sense, isn't there, within the work of awe, and either that is produced by scale or by the sense of darkness itself. I think these are the two, there's certainly those themes in the work I see.
Yeah, there is something. I mean, I think her works are extremely beautiful. I mean, in a sort of simple way, and there's a kind of sublime quality to them. And again, in Seville, I loved spending a day just being with the work and watching the light change. And I do think she's, you know, the longer you spend with the work, the more you appreciate how kind of her kind of formal intelligence. I mean, these spaces are extremely. There'll be lots of, in the work in Seville, there's all kinds of minute, potentially even, who knows, potentially even unwitting resonances between the structures that she's created and the surrounding architecture. So there's a, in the refectory at the cathedral, there's a very beautiful, I believe, 17th century wooden ceiling, which is in influenced very much by Islamic architecture, which is common in that part of Spain. And then in her form beneath, there's this kind of maze of logs encrusted with earth. So you get all of these kinds of fairly simple formal resonances. But yeah, as you say, there is something very extremely dramatic really about the work. And I think again, it's at first I was sort of suspicious, I guess, of that kind of you know, if it's just going for emotional effect, I guess. I was suspicious of that. But then was, I guess, trying to find a way into like reconciling the emotional impact of her work with its potential for colonial anti-colonial critique and sort of raising historical awareness. And I think in Seville, that became even clearer with the links to colonialism of the building.
I mean, it sounds an extraordinary installation, to be fair. And I really encourage listeners to actually look up images of this work. And it's on till March next year, so there is time to go see it. I encourage people to read your article as well. But I think that's all we have time for, unfortunately, unless you've got anything else quickly to add. But I think we might have to move on to Lauren, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah, as you say, people should, if they are in Seville, they should try and go. It's a really a very beautiful, beautiful space and a very beautiful museum.
Thank you. And Lauren, you kindly
Hello.
reviewed Roy Clare Potter's book, For the Wastes, which was
Yes.
published, as I say, earlier by Bookworks. I think what's actually really great about your review is that you describe the book not just in terms of its story, but also as an object. And I think for me, let's begin by describing the object of the book itself. So I think that's actually kind of an interesting entry point to a book, something we don't often discuss. So maybe let's begin with that. Let's describe the book.
Yeah, I thought that with it being described as an experimental artist novel, I would read it experimentally somewhat. And then because of the way I wanted to talk about the story inside as well, the outside of it and the outsides of it and the reading of it became quite important in the review. So it's the cover is printed on this uncoated card, So it's the sort that is kind of matte, which is quite a fashionable finish these days, I think. But it also means that it wears off. So my copy's quite battered now and has kind of, it's like at the corners, it's kind of getting a bit scuffed. And it's got this image of Vanessa Redgrave as a
Yes.
young woman on the front. And that creates a kind of expectation, perhaps, about who the protagonist is and what they might look like and their relation to film, possibly, and maybe the point at which it's set. But that then it kind of takes a while. That's kind of undone, I think, or it was for me by reading what was inside. And then when the picture from the front of the book crops up later in the book, that was a really interesting point for me. And then on the back as well, instead of a sort of blurb, there's just a extract from the book. So what's on the front and the back are also from the inside. And when I was kind of thinking around all of these things, and then around the way books were kind of being discussed in mainstream culture at the time as sort of fashion objects, maybe.
Say more about that. What do you mean when you say fashion objects? What do you mean? Do you mean like in terms of what they're just superficially encountered, or they're just reported on in a certain way? What?
Well, that's why when I sort of got into the Steyerl essay about mean images, that's when that kind of made a bit more sense to me, because honestly, I don't read that many novels, or I don't read a lot of novels that are kind of spoken about in the press a lot, let's say. And so I was kind of thinking, oh, what does it mean for it to be a artist novel? What does it mean for it to be a novel? And I was kind of thinking through what I knew about what novels are at the moment and the kind of discussions I've become, like tangentially aware of around what kind of things get published, how, say, for example, there are like tropes in the covers that are used for books by certain types of people, and then that becomes something to critique, how certain publishers use certain design choices, and then that's kind of ironically referenced quite a lot, say on social media, and then right down to kind of very youth culture things to do with the way books are discussed, like on TikTok and things like that. And so in the review, well, it's quite a short review. I really wanted to reference all these different things, which I tried to do, and you, having edited it, will know that. But yeah, without, going into it too much, because there wasn't space. And then I think it's also with that relevant that at the time I was reading it, it was just that point at which people were pulling out of the Hay Festival, and there was over the Baillie Gifford sponsorship. So there was all this chatter as well from his sort of classic like mainstream commentariat member with parents' names blue on Wikipedia, being really upset that their kind of cultural events were being like targeted politically. And with what Roy Clare Potter's book, what's kind of in the story and the spaces that are described in the book, there was just this kind of interesting like interplay going on, where on the one hand you've kind of got people who have probably been largely unaffected by austerity really up in arms about the fact that something they like or rely on is being kind of undone for political reasons they disagree with. And it felt a bit like, yeah, welcome to what has been going on for everyone for ages. And the characters in the book, were on benefits at certain points, off work sick, can't work, are working in jobs that are generally like low paid and not very well supported. And then, with all that kind of going on, and then in the part where Potter's kind of discussing their influences, when I looked into those a bit, it all just started kind of making sense in a way that it hadn't necessarily during the initial reading, which I just wanted to try and get across, because that I suppose is a kind of experimental way of reading an experimental text, perhaps.
You mean in the sense that actually the references are both in and outside the work, and the way they reach both, yeah, they both reach inside and outside the work as a reader. And also, like, it seems to me like a key aspect of this book is train travel. It seems to be like a recurring narrative device through the book. Could we say something a bit about how that is, or maybe something about why Roy Clare Potter chooses to focus on this particular way of transport?
So kind of working out how to discuss this, I had to kind of think carefully about, you know, what I know of the writer and what I know and what kind of to me as a reader and reviewer is ordinary compared to, you know what, because like, I found a lot of things in the book and the train travel really relatable, but that's, you know, because of my personal situation. Like, it's not necessarily a relatable aspect, but I really enjoyed the way that that these experiences of traveling on the Trans-Pennine Express in particular, which runs from Liverpool to Newcastle, were discussed with a kind of really sort of deep familiarity, and in a way that discussed this kind of the train carriage as a space in which you encounter other people, you kind of rub up against them, you can't always, like, you don't have much control over it, but as the protagonist does in various ways, you can kind of treat that as a game. You know, like, they have a particular seating arrangement that they like to get, and I think for anyone who commutes all of the time or gets a particular train, you end up with those kind of expectations. And then of course train travel as well is associated with not, you know, it's not driving. It's like, you know, there are certain things to do with, well, it's something, again, with so many things in this country that is getting worse and worse, while in a kind of global sense, it should be getting better and better because we should be encouraging more people to use public transport in a very big way.
I remember this quote badly, but I think Margaret Thatcher said anyone over the age of 30 who doesn't drive is basically, you know, a loser or a failure in life.
Exactly, like, yeah. And with that in mind, like, a lot of the ways that I think that the protagonist is kind of described and presents themselves throughout the book kind of goes against that idea, but also it kind of ignores that idea and just looks more deeply into what it means to be someone who isn't existing in a, you know, I don't know, societally sanctioned sort of way. Sure. Who's maybe like an older person without children who takes public transport. Kind of sometimes the protagonist thinks about how she's being perceived by other people. Sometimes she's more kind of describing and thinking through how she feels in relation to them, you know, and I found that really interesting, like the exploration of selves, which comes back to, you know, the train where you're with a bunch of other people, a kind of random assortment, you know, who you may relate or not relate to in various ways.
It's true, isn't it? I mean, I think I remember when I used to try and get the train when I used to have to now work from home, but you know, you'd have often see the same people day in, day out without ever saying a word to them. And I still think back to those people.
Yeah.
They're very familiar faces, but people I never actually, ever shared a word with. It's quite odd.
I know, I always think about when I used to commute between Manchester and Liverpool, there was one train guard who was really cheerful and never checked anyone's ticket. And it was just like, what a comrade.
I know. We need more of these people in our lives. We really do. And actually, I think what's also interesting, and we were talking about the book, but the fact that it's from the series Arrhythmia, and for the series title to actually be in the middle of the book's cover, I think it's also quite a striking detail. It's also, let's say something about that series, because I think it's interesting to talk about. Maybe if we can, maybe some say something about that.
Yeah, so it's part of a series put out by Bookworks that's commissioned specifically by the artist and writer Katrina Palmer. from a call out, which I wanted to describe in the review as well, because that's an interesting way for a book to come about, I suppose. And it's a call out that you might have. Well, I suppose it's quite familiar in the visual arts, but seems from what little I know of mainstream publishing is not particularly common in that world. And yeah, so it's kind of like the way it's branded and marketed is within a series, but a series where the books don't necessarily relate to each other. They kind of came from the same point, let's say, and were edited perhaps by the same people. And yeah, from with everything I was saying earlier about books as objects in this particular moment, the fact there's kind of a set you can collect, mm-hmm. but also, you know, that's one way they exist, but on the other side, it opens up the question of whether this is an artwork or a novel or both, or if it matters whether it's either or, and how then as a kind of ambiguous object it relates to the kind of histories and realities of both those forms of like artistic work.
Yeah. How many more books are part of the series, actually? Do you have that?
There's three. I think three two books. Of them are out so far, and there's one more to come. And then with that in mind, even like in the back, Potter kind of describes being ill and having to take some time off, mm-hmm. and like the patience of the editors, which, yeah, again, was like a interesting thing to have in there and a kind of insight into the creative practice.
Yeah.
You know.
And a certain kind of, I agree with you, it's certain, yeah, exactly. It's a transparency about the way in which work is made and actually the very fragile, to some extent, production of what it is to write a book, and also to make artwork as well. But in this instance, you know, there's something about that that's being foregrounded. You know.
I'm just looking at the page on the Bookworks site now, and I was going to be interested because I'd forgotten this, that there are some quite, that I find kind of funny quotes from people, like the kind of quotes that you would normally get for like, buy this book, it's great.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then the kind of way it's described in a blurb is, I don't know, like a little negative or dramatic, perhaps,
okay.
which you have to do when you're marketing things, right?
Yeah.
Whereas how the aspects that are kind of described appear in the book, I found very ordinary. Mm-hmm. But then again, that comes back to the thing, ordinary and relatable, but only if they're ordinary and relatable to you, you know.
Yeah, that is also true. I mean, obviously someone else has a very different set of relations to the world, but I mean, I think we share something similar, I would imagine. And I'm hoping that many of our listeners as well probably do share something of that too. I will probably round off there, unless you have any further points to make. But I think let's draw a close to this wonderful discussion with the two of you.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know what anyone else thinks of this novel, yeah, and any others in the series, really.
Yeah, and also I think there was a reading the other night, which I couldn't make, actually, at Camden Arts Centre. But
could I ask a slightly random question, which is, I was amazed to see William Origins of the Fae as a reference. William Piatt.
Oh, yeah.
I used to research kind of, I guess, fetish objects, so-called, in the Congo. So I was fairly familiar with him. I mean, he's quite famous in that world, but it seems like a very kind of obscure, strange academic to crop up. And I was wondering if there's any significance to that or where it appears in the book.
Yeah, so that actually appears in another way that felt really kind of gratifying in the reading. So it's a part where the protagonist is engaging with a housemate of theirs in a way that's kind of amusing and a bit creepy. And they're kind of really focusing on this person and this person's objects and the way they exist in the world and what those objects might mean to them and what they do or don't mean to the protagonist. And then the protagonist encounters an academic somewhere else. I kind of won't describe all of it, I don't want the spoilers. But I kind of read all that bit and really enjoyed that passage. And then again, when I got to the end and read the reference and was like, oh, of course, of course. And so that was kind of, it was like, it was nice to have that part that then almost gives you like further reading. Like, you know, in the way an exhibition text might, which isn't necessarily something you would expect from a novel.
Great. Good to have that little extra detail about the book. I would just say thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Michael, for joining today. And I advise readers to read more in the pages of Art Monthly, or indeed visit the exhibition or buy the book. Many thanks. Okay, now I'm joined by Sarah E. James, who's written the art feature this month, Exhibition as Performance, which finds collaborative exhibition formats that offer more complex models than those put forward in Claire Bishop's new book, Disordered Attention. I wondered if one way of approaching your essay would be that you're foregrounding the political potentials in the way artists disorder how we apprehend ideas in today's attention economy. And by that, I mean, in a way, you're talking about Claire and Bishop's book, and it almost feels like a slightly depoliticized position that she's taking. And I feel like you're really kind of moving the ground a little bit back to politics and to the potential of how what disordering something might mean and why an artist is using that as a tactic.
Yeah, that's a nice opening. So I suppose it might or might not be helpful, I suppose, to begin with the sort of interesting motivation for this piece was simply that I had encountered over the last year or so several kind of really exciting sort of performative installations that had got me thinking about my experience and the kind of collective experiences that I'd been through. And I kind of was imagining writing this piece very much framed around them. So this was a kind of encounter with the work of the artist and curator Jade Foster, whose series of exhibitions at Peace and also recent kind of project at Nottingham Primary were really interesting to me because they seemed to manage a very fluid, unfixed, but also very attentive model of curating that was engaged with a new understanding of the performative. And then there was the experience I had of Florence Peake's, what I think is described as normally as a performative installation by the artist Factual Actual Assemble in 2023, which was really incredible and a very intense kind of corporal, somatic, collective sort of experience. I think it was about 90 minutes and it was a sort of collective undoing of painting. I mean, it's been written about quite a lot, so lots of your listeners will probably be aware of it. And then an exhibition I'd been involved in a little bit in writing some of the essays for Brecht Fragments, which has just finished. It was on over the summer at Raven Row, which saw Phoebe von Held and Tom Kuhn do this kind of amazingly ambitious theatrical kind of restaging of some of Brecht's more militant unfinished plays and create this really interesting kind of dialogue with a lot of the archival material, visual material as well from Brecht's archive in Berlin, and sort of reanimate it and reimagine these works in the context of our current kind of political crisis. And this is a funny aside, at that exhibition viewing experience, and it was quite hard to get a place. I went down quite late because some of the performers were ill. Claire Bishop happened to be in the very small group of my audience at Raven Row. And I thought, this is kind of interesting. I haven't seen Claire Bishop for a long time. We're both obviously art historians and art writers. And she was one of the very few people who took photos throughout, and it really irritated me because nobody else was. And I thought, oh, this, you know, I wonder if this relates to what she's been writing about. And I hadn't actually read the book or encountered the thesis or argument until that stage. So I'd already pitched this feature. But that very kind of nice, actual, social, you know, and quite literal bodily kind of encounter with Claire made me sort of look at the material. And then I thought, wow, you know, I didn't want this to be simply a sort of ungenerous critique of the work, because I think, you know, Claire Bishop's writing can be incredibly engaging and incredibly perceptive. But I think in this book, like you said, it seemed to me that it was extraordinarily lacking in terms of its sort of, it was very narrow view and very idiosyncratic historical framing. And it felt like these three models offered this sort of like complete counterexamples to what Bishop's sort of arguing. And in the book, I think it's fair to say, I think Claire Bishop would probably see it as very political, because throughout there are these sort of gestures towards the book itself being this radical sort of disordering of attention itself. So it's reclaiming, Bishop argues, a sort of model of social, engaged, collective, quite youthful. And she allies this sort of collective viewing that she sees as being, you know, very much engaged in a sort of post-internet, post-social media, iPhone-mediated generation, and our kind of current sort of climate of attention deficit, attention economy, you know, kind of crisis and that sort of like memory culture, etc. She necessarily sort of views this as non-modernist, as anti-modernist, as modernism being all about this very patriarchal, very white, very colonial, very sort of a set-centered, unified spectator. And the example she kind of draws on, you know, sort of like theatre before this and the emergence of, you know, cinema and radio, and how there was this sort of kind of class politic of oppressive sort of view that saw the spectator, you know, especially women and the lower classes, as being most prone towards this model of distraction. So it's sort of like she's countering, I guess, Michael Fried, and she's coming at this sort of, you know, anti-modernist position. So therefore, throughout, there's a sense that this is a radical politic and that she's undoing a kind of lazy liberal consensus that we necessarily live in times of disordered attention and distraction. And that distraction is necessarily bad, by purporting to take a kind of longer historical view. But for me, it was utterly kind of lacking in politics, in that there seemed to be these moments of like utterly kind of naive readings of both social media and the ways in which photography and the iPhone becomes a really important frame for the way she's viewing it. So things like Instagram, where she seems to rely on the sense that through Instagram, we're able to kind of retrieve this really authentic sense of our collective viewing position. And she sees this as a kind of radical means of collectivity and a kind of engagement, which for her shifts from, you know, sort of engagement and distraction. This is very healthy, and that it's only really kind of these old sort of like, you know, quite sort of out of touch sort of liberal modernists who would see it as otherwise. And so in the piece, as well as complicating the politics of that, I found that the ideas, particularly with the Brecht show, figures like Bertolt Brecht, Walter Benjamin, you know, they're completely absent from her book. John Hartfield, you know, within the very center of modernity, you already had a very nuanced, very militant, very political model of a much more dialectical spectatorship. I mean, with Brecht, I think he refers to it often as a kind of complex seeing, where the viewer is able to dip in and out of absorption and to be kind of necessarily cynical and to query their own position as a spectator. But it's far from a kind of, you know, superficial distraction. It's a very kind of embodied, collective and militant model of viewing that enables new forms of sort of social relations and political relations and solidarity. And it was quite peculiar. And I think I sort of say in the piece that Walter Benjamin takes up, maybe he gets a footnote. Brecht isn't mentioned at all. And the kind of artists that I was thinking with, like Florence Peake and Jodie Foster, just aren't present. So the book sort of positions this new paradigm of sort of disattention, and it's so particular in the artists and the examples, you know. So Bishop's really only interested in these very kind of long form sort of you know, performances that deliberately kind of, you know, ask for a sort of disassociation and a kind of dipping in and out.
She mentions both people like Anne Imhoff, Lina Lapalite, these kinds of works that we've seen in the past few years that have
and that kind of casual, you know, the idea that you kind of enjoy that this is a looping. And I think then Bishop kind of deploys those sort of terms like interfacing, looping, kind of like from the internet and social media, but doesn't really want to go anywhere else. And I think that for me just needed to be sort of undone a little bit. And it seemed that maybe the sort of, not only the radical kind of decolonial, unfixed queering of a unified subject that you can easily see in Foster and in Peake's work just doesn't fit into that kind of mapping that's going on. So it felt like they needed to be kind of thought about. And then in another, I think another main motivation for writing it was a really tiny show that was put on in Liverpool in March called Limits.
It's an extraordinary show. I really like the sound of this.
Yeah. Well, I don't get excited by exhibitions much anymore, it has to be said, which is a bit, you know, sad. Sometimes it feels like you sort of know what to expect. And I wasn't expecting anything of this particularly. It was a student organized show. An artist, Ada Null, who recently graduated from Liverpool School of Art, and a collective of artists from Liverpool and Manchester and London, Kingston, I think, put on this exhibition at Bridewell Studios, which is a former police station, which was absolutely kind of framed by the idea of performativity and demonstration and interaction, but really testing spectatorship. But it was like this magical experience. It was really kind of from the very beginning and entering into this sort of performative zone. It was a bit like being... There was lots of UV, there was lots of quite a kind of unearthly sort of feelings. There were lots of, you know, different kinds of questioning of spectatorship. Mm. And it was, it seemed very new, it seemed very different. It seemed that it wasn't the same sort of use of live performance. Mm. And one of the things that really runs throughout Bishop's book is this sort of, you know, quite unashamed sort of celebration of youth and this sort of alignment with this sort of younger culture of the, you know, social media, of kind of digital savvy, of sort of this sort of, you know, new generation that needs to be engaged with. And I just found it very interesting that this was exactly that generation. It was the youngest people, you know, emergent sort of art students and emergent artists who are engaging with this sort of very post-internet kind of culture. And social media was absolutely, you know, kind of part of their lives, but actually had kind of conjured up something that was completely and utterly counter to that, and that was based in these absolutely material, embodied, visceral, somatic, and collective engagements. And
yeah,
that's sort of,
it seems to me like the work itself seemed oppositional to the capacity to be then photographed. There was a kind of knowingness about how the work would be later then disseminated, or if it could be disseminated.
Exactly, and a testing, I think, of those boundaries. A kind of, there was almost a sort of, so lots of the work actually sort of both photographed marvelously, because it was, lots of it was dark. It was a bit like being in a nightclub. It was really playing with UV and these kind of like, you know, sort of amazing violet kind of glowing sort of substances that rendered the show very different the next day when you saw it in daylight, but also kind of obscured the work. So it created these sort of pseudo images, which I thought was a really kind of clever take on this sort of like horribly Instagram ready, you know, sort of Kusama loving spectacularization of art that needs to be able to be kind of manufactured to be uploaded and liked online. So I thought that was kind of clever, I think.
Yeah, I love that description where you make this sort of connection between someone photographing their brunch and then photographing the museum. I think that's so true, and also really speaks to how many people actually use art now in terms of identity and like flagging up a kind of position for themselves, or coolness, or whatever you want to call about, you know, how you want to ascribe a certain thing about an artwork.
Yeah, and I think it must be really difficult to contend with that when you're an artist, because, you know, I've seen that from inside institutions, my time at Tate, the way in which, you know, institutions as big as Tate and other museums are kind of beholden to that, the aesthetics of Instagram and the kind of power of those sort of images in bringing in, you know, audiences. So I think it's really interesting. And I loved the part of Florence Peake's collective kind of exhibition that I talk about, performative installation, was exactly that, playing again with the sort of reduction of a performance or of an agent and a kind of collective to a sort of flat 2D representation. Because there's one part in that factual actual ensemble performance where the sort of main, one of the main figures is this sort of like rendered completely two-dimensional, so that this funny sort of paper cutout patchwork painting of a sort of melting, you know, colourful sort of painterly figure, and they can't see at all, so they're kind of staggering around and carefully groping to be able to move around the space, and they're rendered really sort of fragile and precarious as a subject. But that to me seemed like a really clever way of playing with what it is to be an agent and what it is to be an image. And I think that's sort of interesting. And then with the Jade Foster example, it felt like it just really helped to take apart some of the supposed politics in terms of this sort of decolonial, non-binary gesturing in Bishop's book, where it was a really, like, for me, the equivalent of a very poor kind of postmodern identity politics, but, you know, remade in this sort of like post-social media guise, and that it seemed to really play to those ideas. And there was one particular bit, I think, where Bishop deals with Christina Sharp's idea of care and attention, and seems to momentarily sort of suggest that this is kind of maybe quite interesting, but actually, really, in essence, only, you know, it falls back on this idea of a sort of unified model of absorption, which may as well be akin with Michael Fried. And I thought this was, it was a really strange, kind of peculiar write-off of those sort of potentials. And I think what was really interesting for me in my kind of conversations with Jade was the way in which they actually were invested in a very different understanding of liveness and unfixity and the possibilities of a kind of rethinking of the performative, which didn't necessarily need to be public, which could be intimate, which could be quiet, which could be done, you know, in a smaller group, or it could be done in a larger collective, but also in engaging with the work of younger Black artists, that was really like seeing the potential radicality of online kind of environments for, you know, new transgressive subjects and Black bodies that weren't necessarily only repressed and sort of pigeonholed and stereotyped and victimized and the subjects of a sort of, you know, of racism. So it felt to me like the kind of model of care and attention implicit in Jade Foster's project also problematized that sort of doing away with attention. And what I didn't want to do was kind of, you know, appear, which I think is probably the way in which Bishop would see a lot of her critics, as a kind of, you know, old-fashioned technophobe who was sort of writing off, you know, all new technologies as necessarily, you know, dangerously kind of eroding our memetic functions and ruining the kind of sense of memory and politic. But, you know, I think that there is certainly some space for what she's saying and some use, and maybe a very, you know, a small kind of you know, number of works can certainly be categorized in the way that she's doing, but she felt the need to go beyond this and claim it as an entire new paradigm. And I think she sort of does say, you know, there is a new way of seeing art and performance, a new paradigm of viewing, and it is absolutely one mediated by, you know, the mobile phone and mediated by social media and about distraction. And for me, that seems a dangerous position, I think, to do away with that sort of possibility of a more radical kind of form of
the other day I was looking at old exhibition photography and shows at Cubit Gallery, and I was looking back at that and I'm thinking, you know, there's not that wealth of image, a trove of images that we now have necessarily about a certain work. You know, you can go online and look at endless exhibitions of images of an exhibition, but there's quite a kind of, it's almost like a quietness. Sort of an aside really, but They're all part of a kind of portrait of the way in which we look and think about art.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, maybe my comment, it was a bit of a throwaway and deliberately sort of provocative line that people can take photographs in exhibitions as they might of their flat whites or their brunches or whatever. But I think there is a sense that there's a peculiar naivety in believing that you are able to access a kind of a really authentic image or a really authentic subjecthood. You know, I think Bishop talks about how often after an exhibition or a performance, she'll look online and she'll look at social media to see other people who've been there, to see if their experience, and empathy matches her own. And I thought that was really strange, because I don't know, you know, I wonder how much you can really get from those kind of, you know, swipes and imagery. And equally, like, I think she makes a point about those long durational kind of, you know, I mean, like you said, she's talking about Pablo Bronstein and Kelly Spooner and Annie Imhoff and stuff, this idea idea that these kind of performances are somehow made for the camera, and that there's an interesting kind of aesthetics of image. And I think in most cases, actually, they're not. I mean, they're actually really quite banal and uninteresting images, and that in itself is an interesting, you know, thing.
Yeah.
They're anti-spectacular, but they're not in the way of a kind of authentic performative image, which Bishop seemed to be proposing. So, yeah, I mean, I don't like bashing people too much, not academically, because it always seems that in a sense, some of these things could just, you know, be infinite conversations that are in a kind of echo chamber, and they're not so, you know, relevant. But I think there are greater stakes. And I suppose as somebody who's so engaged in arts education and is teaching in an art school and has taught art history for like so long now, I think the ways in which this culture of distraction feeds into those frameworks and, you know, the kind of models of reading and learning and engaging collectively, that, you know, there is more at stake, I think, than just an academic argument, you know, that Bishop's making. I guess it's a kind of post-Octoberist, you know, desire to be able to, you know, have a kind of fashionable paradigm naming, you know, kind of book. I guess that's what it comes from. I guess that's what was appealing to Verso. But I think it's kind of damaging when you are sort of like really losing a whole politic and a whole sense of a kind of historical field, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Should we wrap it up there? I think so. We've got. I really recommend our listeners to read Sarah's brilliant essay, which is in the October issue of Art Monthly, and it is a really fabulous piece. I was reading it again this morning, and yeah, it's a really great piece. So I do recommend it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It was lovely to talk.